You're listening to Foresight, a podcast about making work better. I'm your co-host, Mark Edgar, a former consultant and coach who now works as a chief people officer on a mission to make work more human.
And I'm Naomi Teitelman, a former big firm consultant and HR executive, now striving to make work better one organization and one leader at a time. Every week, we'll discuss the latest trends that are impacting the new world of work to help you be a better leader for the future.
Welcome, everybody, to Foresight, a podcast about making work better. My name is Mark Edgar, one of your co-hosts, and it's my pleasure today to be joined by Corinne Prudian. Corinne, great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you and I met, I don't think we've ever met. Actually, we've always just been kind of virtual kind of friends and colleagues, I think.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, like many a person in the day, but because we met during that thing called COVID.
Yes.
And you were doing some very interesting work, and we partnered with you on a kind of paper you were doing around creating the next normal for HR. But I always position you as being a foresight specialist. So I think without taking anything away from all of our other guests, you're the perfect guest for Foresight the podcast. But maybe we could start with you just telling a little bit, our audience, a little bit about yourself. That'd be great.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me. I'm a career strategist. That's the best, I think, easiest way to describe what I do. I started out my career in risk advisory and risk practices. So I sort of started out as a strategist in cyber and privacy security and the like. And after a number of years at Deloitte, kind of working through that subject matter, I realized it wasn't my favorite subject matter. So went back to school and sort of moved over to human-centered design, more innovation-focused strategy work. And that's where I've lived in my career for the better part of, I think over a decade now. 6 years ago, I started a growth strategy consultancy with two business partners. And that's the capacity in which we know each other. So Faculty of Change is myself and two business partners, and we have a team. And that's me.
Amazing. Thank you. And I think I've always found the Faculty of Change is such a fantastic name for a company because it has so many interesting connotations. So yeah, great job on that. But maybe just to give a bit more depth around what it is you do, because I think it's such interesting work that you do. And yeah, I've had the opportunity to meet with all of your business partners and all three of you.
Yes.
But some really interesting backgrounds you have, and you approach, I think, the world of work and customers and everything such a different way. But yeah, maybe if you wouldn't mind just giving a bit more of a flavor, that'd be great.
Not at all. Thank you. Yeah, I guess we are an interesting trio. So myself being a strategy background, business school, more traditional management consulting. And when I met Jared and Dylan, we were all three at Idea Couture. And Jared's background is quite interesting. He's legal by training, so a lawyer, and sort of did more VC related work in his sort of career and upbringing. And Dylan is quite unique as well in that his background is research and anthropology. So when you put us all together, I guess that's where the interesting perspectives come from. So as Faculty of Change, we're a growth strategy firm. And what that means is we work with legacy businesses, primarily Canadian businesses that have been around for, 100 years sometimes. And what we do with them, frankly, tactically, is we do research, we help them understand that research, so we develop insights, and then we use that knowledge to help create new growth opportunities, new directions for the business. And I think that's, first of all, I love it because it's lots of fun, and I love engaging with researchers and doing research, and I love the understanding that comes from it for myself, being very selfish, but also for our clients. Usually when clients are approaching us, it's because what they have been doing as a strategy has worked well in the past. You know, they're good operators, they're good marketers, they're good tacticians. And what ends up happening over time is your strategy sort of loses steam. And so what was working for you in the context in which you developed that strategy starts to fade or change and shift. But it's hard to keep track of some of those changes and also be a good operator in a lot of cases. And so what ends up happening is they'll come to us and say, we've done what we've done very well for the last 25 years. What do we do next? And so we'll use the insights that we've developed to determine new product strategies, new marketing strategies, and oftentimes new sort of high level business strategy that includes purpose, mission, values, working with CHROs as well.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's really interesting. I think back to the conversations we've had in the past, and it strikes me that, I think I remember conversations, particularly with you and Dylan, who's the anthropologist, and just the kind of deep curiosity you have about the world. And it, you know, it's kind of almost never ending. And it's, you know, you're not necessarily looking for like a data point to form a theory on. It's just having this real curiosity. And I remember speaking to Dylan and thinking, I don't think I know what an anthropologist is. So I'm just wondering, to be fair to our listeners, whether they may not know what an anthropologist is. So I just was seeing here that it's the study of aspects of humans within past and present societies. So I think for anybody like me and many of our listeners with an HR kind of perspective on the world, then that background, I think, is so interesting. And that combined with the other insights that you and Jared offer, I think just, it's pretty unique. So it's a great, great trifecta, I guess. So yeah, thank you for that.
Thank you.
So we start with the check-in, and check-in question for today for you, because I was trying to keep that theme, because I always try and be, I kind of always overthink the check-in question, is what are you looking forward to right now, Kareem?
I'm looking forward to this conversation. I think I really enjoyed it. Yeah. Try to be present. I'm doing my very best to really take things as they come. And I think with consulting work and with owning your own business, it's very easy to get caught up in everything ahead and getting a little worked up even. And so I'm really doing my best these days to cultivate an intention. And so, yes, I'll say I'm really looking forward to this conversation with you.
Excellent. Yeah. I'd been slightly disappointed if you said the next meeting or something. That would have, that would maybe not have got things off to the best start. But no, I appreciate that. I think I do find actually when I do these with the guests that it does give an opportunity. Like people don't often ask you some of these questions, and just to kind of pause and almost like celebrate some of the things you do and just be kind of proud of the expertise you have, because that's what we're looking for. So I think we'll have a great conversation. So thank you for that. Hopefully we won't let you down as we get into
it. No, never.
So you touched on this a little bit already, but as I said, you're kind of experts in strategic foresight. And we know one of the big themes at Future Forward is obviously the rate of change and the huge exponential change that the organizations are facing. So could you just give your thoughts around, what is strategic foresight in the context of a changing world? How would you perhaps summarize that for folks?
Yeah, thanks. And I'll start by saying, I am not a strategic foresight expert. I do work with them. And so it is a discipline, that I have come to really love and enjoy, and it is incredibly useful. So hopefully those who are listening who are strategic foresight experts won't be disappointed with my response. So strategic foresight is really this discipline of kind of understanding the quality of change. And so it's not, I think often it gets misinterpreted as a sort of predictive tool. And while a lot of the research and the outputs of that research can point to what may seem like a predictive take on where things are headed, the intention for strategic foresight is really to be able to catalog changes all around. So, you'll look at changes in culture, changes in society, changes in technology, even education, macro, micro, at whatever level makes sense for the organization and for the people who you're talking to and problem solving for. And I think the intention is to make sense of those changes, to get messy, to go to the far reaching elements of what is changing, what we call early signals of change, weak signals of change. And in aggregate, take all of those weak signals of change, and while taking a step back, seeing what makes sense, what's coming to the surface when you, catalog some of these changes. The objective being not predictive, but rather to say, okay, if this is all the change that's happening and these are sort of all the scenarios we might encounter in the future, what as a strategy, which is where I come in, what as a strategy might you do to prepare yourself for all these possible scenarios or for most of these possible scenarios? I think it's really a tool for preparedness. Whereas in contrast, I think a lot of trend reporting is sort of very near term, what's already happened, what's happening today, describing a change that has already arrived. Strategic foresight, by contrast, is a little more forward-looking, future forward-looking, and is describing changes that might happen. So it's less predictive and not sensitive.
Yeah.
Does that answer the question? Is that?
Yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah, I think that's really helpful. And I think there's, you know, just a couple of things to maybe pick out to make sure I understood. But I love that phrase you said around it's about the quality of change. Because I think sometimes we do get a bit maybe obsessed with the quantity of change without necessarily thinking about that important aspect of quality. Mm-hmm. And I can there's a point around the interconnectedness of everything, which I just recorded a podcast with Gary Turner a couple of weeks ago, who's a colleague in the UK who thinks very much about the interconnectedness of everything. And so that, you know, that certainly resonates with me. We've just written a kind of trends report, which I think by the time this goes out, it might be out, but it's that distinction between something which, you know, we're essentially talking about the impact of six macro trends on the world of work, which is, you know, like lots of people do. It's kind of our take on it, which we're, you know, we're quite proud of, but it's just our take. But I can see how that distinguishes from where you're looking at these kind of weak signals of change and how that is then actually becoming a better predictor to help you then prepare for change. Am I understanding it in the right way?
Yeah. I think that's a great distinction. So if you take for strategic foresight, it's really an exercise in preparedness. Right. Whereas if you take trend reports, it's an exercise in responsiveness.
Right. Yeah. I like that. Yeah. And it's almost this kind of maybe distinction if, you know, because people would often say, well, you can't predict the future. And of course we can't, you know, we're sat here now and anything can happen. We can have your dog could bark, or my dog could bark, maybe more like my dog. So all sorts of things could happen, but we can't sort of then sit in isolation. And, you know, again, not, you know, all roads lead back to the pandemic, but it did strike me as that was one of the examples where perhaps we demonstrated that we weren't necessarily prepared for that kind of event and, you know, of a seismic scale and how we respond to it. So I guess that makes me wonder, are you seeing as a result of that experience, organizations perhaps being a bit more aware of the importance of being prepared and doing this kind of work?
Yeah, it is. Yes. In a lot of instances, I think through COVID and even post-COVID, there's been a lot of different industries, different types of leaders approaching us. And whereas I think there was sort of a very clear profile pre-COVID, what's interesting about it is I think it reflects on, like, it reflects the existential threat. You know, so I think leaders who are attuned to the lack of control you can have over everything, the fact that a strategy can be implemented, but of course, there's all these other elements you can't account for. And COVID being one of those examples of no one could have really predicted, maybe some people could have, but nobody could have really predicted the scale, the impact, the magnitude of that on everything.
Yeah,
I think it's called a lot of leaders to really think about those existential threats. So, you know, for one of our clients that came to us during the pandemic, an industry we hadn't really served in the past, which is hospitality, luxury hospitality. And their question was super existential, you know, like the CEO, the CCO were really questioning, we make money on rooms that we sell, that we rent, you know, and if people are no longer going to travel, or if this is going to be a continued, sustained interruption to our business, what are their businesses? Might we be in? Because if not, that's a real threat to our existence. Like, how do we continue to exist as a brand, as a business, if no one's traveling, if no one's coming to our rooms?
Yeah. So almost using it as John Cotter kind of burning platform kind of way of just exploring the situation.
Yeah. And it's really intended to take away the fear. Like when you engage in this preparedness exercise, it's not meant to strike people with fear of and into action. It's rather like calmly evaluating, you know, qualitatively evaluating what might come your way so you can prepare.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know people do this, but I was like, imagine like it's all going on and people reaching for the playbook that, you know, they had ready for this situation. And that, you know, people, I think, talked about that, you know, the lack of a playbook at all sorts of different levels, both at societal kind of government level as well as within organizations. So yeah, that should give you a bit of reassurance. But I think it's also interesting. It feels like there has to be a level of kind of humility from leaders to really be prepared to kind of lean into this and to have their strategy tested in some respect. So it makes me wonder whether, you know, do you see any almost like success criteria for organizations who do kind of really get the value of this work in terms of the kind of characteristics they have at all?
The characteristics of the leadership.
Or the organization. I'm just curious whether there's kind of certain things you see that, you know, in terms of organizations that perhaps are more likely to lean into to thinking about working in this way. Because I think it's, for me, it demonstrates a level of maturity and a level of sophistication in some respects, where we're trying to almost step away from the busyness of what we're doing every day, feeling as though we're making progress.
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think from a leadership standpoint, I think as leaders, depending on how you kind of, I'll say in quotes, like grown up into your leadership role, you might be more inclined to assume the role of someone who's meant to have answers. Whereas this really begs the person in question to like pause and have more questions, acknowledge that they have questions that they don't have answers to. So to your point, that vulnerability, that humility is critical to stand up to your teams and as a leader, even to your board, to your shareholders, whatever the case might be, and say, these are questions we can't quite understand right now, but I'm working on it. And as an organization, as organizations, even in the HR practice, I think there's a lot of, in business, we tend to look to the next quarter, even to the next year. And I understand that a lot of organizations will do a 3-year planning cycle, but even the act of planning is tactical.
Right.
And so the type of organization or the moment, it's not even, I wouldn't categorize it as the type of org, but rather like there's moments that call to action. So seeing things changing and not necessarily knowing how to plan for them. And the best example I can give is a retailer that we worked with that was seeing that their year over year, there's, you know, when you look at the same stores that you evaluate year over year in specific regions, it wasn't growing at the same, like their sales were not growing at the same rate that they were used to seeing. That growth, the rate of growth was tapering off. And I think that signaled a change coming, or perhaps like a loss of relevance in some way. They weren't sure. In other words, they were saying to themselves, there's a need to respond differently here. Like we can't just plan for this, because you can't just amplify marketing, we'll open more stores. At some point, that strategy hits the wall.
Right.
And so it requires a shift or a thinking rethink in a sense. So I think that the quality of the organization or the moment is that moment where we need to go back to square one and rethink our strategy.
Yeah, no, that's a great example. Yeah. Yeah, I think the vulnerability point's interesting as well, because there is this sense, I think that's a word that we throw around a lot, but this to me gives a really kind of solid example of where that is really important, you know, as leaders think about these things. So yeah, they're really interesting. You talked a bit earlier about the kind of approach that's taking, kind of, you know, cataloging changes all around. Mm-hmm. And I love the point around looking at those kind of far reaching elements and thinking about those weak signals of change. So as we think about the world of work, and I appreciate that you'll be kind of delving into all sorts of kind of specific sectors, and talked about luxury hospitality earlier and others. So maybe looking for it from a more generic perspective, but do you see any of those things? What are those kind of weak signals of change that you're seeing from your perspective? Because I guess the point is, I think you do have a pretty unique perspective around that, both as you as an individual, but also faculty of change.
I think in the world of work, I think about some of the research that we've done. So we just recently in January published we lovingly call them predictions, even though I just finished saying they're not meant to be necessarily predictions, but they're our fun take on, we call it nearly now. So what we're seeing on the horizon. And I think even within that, there were a couple elements that maybe aren't necessarily work related, but speak to societal and cultural shifts. And one of them was around this changing notion of selfhood, which is a bit heady, I understand, but yeah, good. So effectively, this notion that digital platforms and how we have these various identities through hybrid work, through Instagram, through whatever platform you're on and sort of engaging in, you might have different personas, and that affects how we understand our own selfhood. Anthropologists love to talk about self, but really it is sort of like a bifurcation of how we understand ourselves from being one individual in one place of work to you know, an individual with one persona or one kind of self, perhaps in various worlds of work. You know, when you think about people who have one corporate gig and then will have other kind of side gigs, thinking about the fact that someone who arrives at the workplace physically one day, but is working remotely the next day, the way you understand yourself and the way you show up and present yourself might be different across these different platforms. And that has implications for the world of work. It has implications for primarily the one we had identified was for marketers, because marketers will study and identify personas to market to and to create campaigns for. But when the self is bifurcated, who's the persona you're marketing to? Who's the persona you're creating experiences for, whether that's an employee experience or a marketing experience? So this notion that we're in a way being pulled apart to these different selves.
I guess we're choosing to pull ourselves apart by creating different personas, as you say, on different platforms. And as you mentioned, you know, as marketeers think about customer experience, HR folks think about the employer experience, so those issues would arise. And it also strikes me that there's a bit of a tension there between this idea of organizations, you know, you often hear organizations say, we want to make sure we're being inclusive, we allow the whole person to come to work. It's like, well, which bits of the person? And do we know what all those different bits are? So it's, that's really interesting. I think we could do a podcast just on that. I think we'll have to bring you back, Kareem. But yeah, that's really interesting. Any other themes come to mind from your Nearly Now report that you think would be relevant?
I think one of the other ones that I was sort of really engaged in was sort of the end of self-help. Effectively, as a society, especially as a North American society, we've become quite obsessed with like optimizing the self. And I wonder, like, some of this is more of a contemplation. So I'm not sure where this will end up, when it would end up, wherever it's going. But it strikes me that there is a tremendous amount of pressure on self-improvement, and books and podcasts and influencers and Tony Robbins and whomever you're following, you know, their focus is on, again, the self. And naturally, that implies that the more you focus on yourself, the less you're focused on sort of the broader community and the fabric of those more community-oriented structures, what might have been a community center or a church. And depending on which, you know, cultural and communal groups that you belong to, some of those are sort of eroding, especially the church in North America. And so it begs the question of, like, if we're increasingly focused and obsessing on optimizing ourselves, we're focusing less on the communal well-being. And so partly idealistically and hopefully partly based on what I was seeing, my sense is that in these tough times, economically and culturally and societally, we're going to start to see a little bit of that pullback to the communal.
Right.
So the rise up of, and we're starting to see it already, unions, you know, mutual aid organizations, sort of, I know that these are very different things, but I think whenever there is an opposing force that rises, I start to see, okay, what's the equal opposing force that might come up that counters it?
Yeah.
And I think, especially with unions, there's been a lot of, there's been negative talk about unions, depending on who you're talking to, of course, but I wonder if that'll start, our perspective on mutuality will start to shift. Yeah. And make it into something really positive.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, one thing I've thought about a lot in the past is just this, and I think I mentioned it on here, just as you said, the kind of decline in people's affiliation with other kind of community groups. So, you know, be it churches or other things. And in my mind, that kind of creates an opportunity for business to be a force of good. But I hadn't thought about that from the perspective of that's, you know, largely because people perhaps have been focusing so much on self. So I just want to make sure I understand what is it that you think is the, again, to use your language, what's the kind of, I don't know whether it's a far-reaching element or a weak signal of change that's suggesting that people are starting to focus a little less on self? What is it that you're seeing there that is the then potentially causing that trigger around increased a shift back to more communal aspects like unions?
I think the weak signal that I've seen is that there's a frenzied approach to the self-help aspect these days, from biohacking to not that these things are necessarily bad, but when you put them together, biohacking and meditative and, you know, engaging in all these quite expensive and extreme rituals of optimizing yourself to be better in your profession, to be the best, I don't know, marketer, to be the best real estate agent.
Yeah.
But this obsession with perfectionism, in a moment where the economy just doesn't have space for everyone to be optimized,
right? Yeah, yeah.
is going to turn optimally.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I was having a beer with a friend in the talent acquisition world last night, and he was, you know, reflecting on the market and how the market has shifted in his organization. I think we haven't quite seen that in our organization, touch wood, in terms of candidates. But yeah, I can see that. I love that word frenzy, because it feels like the people looking for that hack, the, you know, I'm thinking about the powders that people put in their drink so they can capture every single protein and vitamin that they ever need. And yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. There is also a couple of things we've read where people, you know, there was a lot of expressions of anger and frustration at the lack of communal spaces, communal opportunities, different communities rising up even. Like, I mean, we've seen this quite clearly, but yeah, I think that was part of it as well.
Yeah. No, it's great where they're just illustrating the work you do, because you're kind of, it's just, you're looking at both ends of what, you know, if it's spectrum's the right word, but yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Well, I'm just kind of thinking there's a connection there to the report we did.
Yeah.
It was very much the similar process, and, you know, full credit to Faculty of Change for doing a huge amount of the heavy lifting. I think Naomi and I's role was just to kind of nod sagely at the appropriate times when you came up with all your amazing theories. But this was back in June 2020. So the world was in a strange place at that time. And at the time, you identified six themes, which I remember. I mean, it's not a million miles away from your kind of nearly now structure, but you categorized these six themes into three categories. So we had what has changed, what is changing, and what will change next. So almost a bit of a kind of, I guess, a timeline there, a bit of a predictive way of thinking about these different things. So I figured that we would just introduce them quickly. I'll put the link to the report in the show notes, and we could kind of rate ourselves in terms of how well we did. And I think most of them are pretty self-explanatory, but we'll talk them through at a relatively high level. So you remember this, Karine, because kind of you held the pen on a lot of this. But what has changed first? So the first one was the end of the work from home prejudice. Mm-hmm. So how do you think we did with that one?
I mean, for all of these, because we worked on it and we, you know, sort of collaborated on this, I'm also curious to hear your thoughts on it, especially as an HR expert. But from my purview, I think it has, like, bang on. I think in 2020, we were grappling with it. Some organizations were really banging their heads against the wall about this hybrid or work from home perspective. And it, as a culturally, like, the workplace, notions of workplace and productivity have shifted so drastically that I don't even recall a time when we didn't have hybrid work in our language. And it was such a shift, such a rapid and drastic shift, that I think there's no way of going back. Although I know that there's some organizations that has held on to the need for people to, like, bums and seats coming back to office. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think you're right. I mean, I think for me, it was the most symbolic element of the way work changed during the pandemic. And I think it was a symbol of all sorts of other things that were going on in reality, but the most symbolic one, you know, interesting, that's the one that we reference here first. And I think maybe if I'm a bit more precise about the language, I'd maybe say that there hasn't been as much progress as I'd hoped there would, because I think there is still prejudice. I think it's that word, there's a prejudice around people working from home. I think there's a sense I have that leaders perhaps tolerate it, but they're tolerating it because they know that they it's the way the market has changed. You know, we're both sat recording this podcast from home, and you know, we have that flexibility. But I think there is still a level of prejudice, but the market has certainly shifted that way. And I think, you know, I don't think we will return to 5 days in the office, but whether people are kind of compromising on that in terms of organizations or whether they're accepting it, as perhaps where there's still work to be done, despite the examples that we've had folks like Nick Bloom on kind of quoting the fact that you are much more productive at home, etc. So, but yeah, I think definitely one that was a big shift, and something that will, I think, be sustainable for sure.
I think as I'm reflecting on that one, I also realize that the prejudice now goes both ways in that as an employee, when you're applying for roles, you know, when whether the role and the organization you're applying to be part of, it says hybrid work or entirely virtual work or otherwise, you are immediately judging and understanding the workplace culture based, like that is one word that dictates the culture I might be part of, which I think is very interesting. So it's become like a moniker for understanding what that workplace looks like.
And then there's also, we shouldn't forget, particularly as a chief people officer for an organization where the vast majority of our people don't have the opportunity to work from home, that there's a kind of prejudice or, you know, I guess bias in there somewhere as well, for sure.
Totally.
So we're talking about sort of 4% to 40%, I think it was, of the Canadian working population back in the day when I had that number to hand, that were able to even have the opportunity to work from home. So the next one, number two, the new CEO, chief empathy officer. So maybe I'll start with this one just to give you a bit of a break. But I think this one was interesting. This was a term we heard kicking around, certainly around that time. I remember a few people bringing this to our attention as well. And I think was what was required at the time. You know, we wanted our leaders, and CEO was perhaps a bit of a representation of leadership more broadly, having much more empathy. And again, I think we would say that, yes, that happened. I think people had much more focus on it, all sorts of understanding around even what that word meant and what it required for people to be more empathetic to individual circumstances and trying to create a level of understanding. Again, I wouldn't claim to be a cynical person. I kind of question whether that's still there now to the same extent. I think it becomes very individual to the leader. I'm fortunate in my role to be surrounded by lots of chief empathy officers, but I know that that's not always the case. What are you seeing on that one?
I think I agree. I think this is another one where it was a hopeful prediction in a sense, and I think you're right. In that moment, it was certainly what was required. It was table stakes. You know, I think that the language that CEOs were able to put out there, if it was not empathetic, it was going to be completely horrific. So there was no choice, but I think you're right. And that it depends on the person.
Yeah.
Less pressure to show up this way currently, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think then perhaps again gives it similar to the work from home in some ways, if you're able to frame it in the right way, it gives you an opportunity to be quite distinctive from competitors.
Yes.
So something, because it was so well received, something not to lose sight of when the times have changed. So excellent. So next category is what is changing. So I'll ask you to lead off with the first one, which was bio status, health becomes passport. Remember that one?
Yes, I do. I think our intention with this theme of change was really like this shift from your health information being quite private, and it still is, you know, legally, but this, that we would be shifting to this notion where our health information would have to be a little bit more public so that we could navigate society, enter certain spaces, be in certain places. And for a time that was a requirement.
Mm.
But I think thinking about it now in the moment we're in today, bio status has sort of taken on I think we were right, but it's taken on a whole new meaning where, you know, health is a status symbol. And I go back to that discussion we had just a few moments ago around biohacking. And I think there is a status element when you talk to folks and they're talking about all these rituals they engage in and all these devices they purchase and vitamins that are, you know, luxury vitamins that they take to optimize their body and their mind and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that has become, in some circles, quite a status symbol.
Mm-hmm.
I think about another prediction we wrote that was around longevity, and you know, there's like the Silicon Valley tech titans have invested in all these biological reprogramming, like longevity, to be able to live longer and live potentially forever, and they can invest in that kind of research because they have the funds and the status, but it also dictates where that research goes, because they're the ones sort of investing in it. So I think bio status is this interesting one that's still changing. And I see it as very much as in some circles, it's a tremendous status symbol.
Mm. Yeah.
Not in necessarily all the good ways, but I'm not meant to judge them, so.
No. You're just there to report on them in some ways, for sure. But yeah, no, it's really interesting. Yeah, it's kind of, I wonder whether, again, I hadn't thought about this before, but that sense of kind of the sense of kind of mortality we had during the pandemic, and whether that's,
yes.
I don't know, whether people did, you know, are more people fitter now, going to gym more now than they did before, because yes. they all went off and bought their Pelotons, whatever it is. So yeah, really interesting. The next one is, which may feel more relevant, not these, I think these are all relevant to the HR audience, because these are all things that we're having to kind of tackle with in society, but maybe a quick one for us, but a digital first employee experience, I'd say yes, you know, that kind of is changing and changed. So we've seen a kind of plethora of platforms and a plethora of kind of approaches to make sure things are digital first. People are connecting much more through these virtual platforms and using SharePoint, et cetera, to a greater or lesser extent, depending on the organization. So I think huge strides made there. I think the lens of the HR leader into that one, from my perspective, is it's a little bit overwhelming. It's like so many platforms, it's kind of knowing where to start and, you know, sometimes stepping back from that and not forgetting, going back to your background, that kind of human-centered approach to make sure that you really think about what it is that people need and not layering too much digital application into that, into those interactions, I think is important as well. But yeah, any thoughts on that?
I think you nailed it. I also think about digital experiences more broadly, in that, you know, there's so much focus on these various digital platforms, employee experiences, of course, being one of them, but all the other ones we navigate, Uber and food ordering and so forth. And I think about another prediction we wrote, where in order to get critical mass, in order for these platforms to be successful, they have to get a certain number of companies, individuals, so forth, to sign on. And I think once you do, it starts to change. The platform's business model starts to change even. And so you sort of start to see where they're cutting costs and where they're sort of. And so it'll be interesting to see how employee experience platforms come together, you know, whether there's an aggregation of sorts in the industry, whether it continues to be overwhelmingly pinpoint solutions, and or if we'll see a degradation in sort of the experiences that they offer, because they're serving so many clients,
right?
Because they have to survive.
Yeah.
I think this one will be quite interesting.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, really good point. What will change next is the final category. So two here, one which we perhaps touched on already, but holistic wellbeing was the first. So we've touched on kind of health a couple of times in the conversation. Anything, does that, you know, is that encapsulated in this holistic wellbeing theme, do you think, or is it a bit more than that?
I think it is. I think a lot of organizations, there's always an intention of that shift from working hard to working well. I think depending on the industry, depending on the leadership, that is, you know, there's still strides to be made there. But I also think about work that we've done in the group benefits space of late that informed a little bit of our health and well-being research in the last year. And I think that there's a shift in the notion around productivity. I mean, group benefits, the intention is, of course, to provide benefits to employees, but also the end goal for these benefits programs is productivity, return to work. And so the metric that those benefits programs are always measured by is how quickly or how efficiently there is a return back to work. And I think how those programs are designed, how those benefits are structured, is also shifting. So this is another interesting one, I think, that continues to evolve, and how we understand well-being in the workplace and outside of it, and how we structure those benefits programs accordingly, will evolve as we work to better understand different employee groups. Like you said, some don't ever work from home, some are frontline staff. And so how we understand these different dimensions of employees, employee groups, and their needs, and what it means to be well, and by extension, what it means to be productive, will be an interesting ongoing conversation.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was talking about that this week with my team on the well-being side. We think about what some of the lead indicators could be around well-being, because it feels like it's a, I don't know, I keep using the word plethora, but a plethora of lag indicators around LTD, STD, return to work, etc. But it's thinking about what those lead indicators could be. The last one, it felt like a lofty claim at the time in terms of what would change next, which was this idea of conscious capitalism. So kind of famous book by Raj Sisodia on this topic. But yeah, the idea of organizations having a much greater sense of what their role is in society and capitalism being a force of good. And there's lots of examples of that. But again, any thoughts on whether this is, was this a hopeful one, do you think, Karen?
Or? It was. But I think, but I have noticed, I'll say very specifically in my world, the kinds of conversations we're having with clients aren't necessarily around conscious capitalism using that language, but rather around purpose. So every time we're engaging with clients, there is an extended conversation where there wasn't previously an appetite to talk about purpose.
Mm.
I think there's an awareness now that greenwashing can be called out, that having the wrong stance on certain topics can be called out. And so there is a heightened consciousness. And I think we saw that in the years that followed 2020 with the various movements that took place, very important movements that took place. And I think overall, the call is still to purpose. So that has not changed from my standpoint.
Mm. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I can see that. And that's, I think, really important, because that from that, you can then start, it's almost like an evolution in some ways. From that, perhaps you can then kind of move towards some of those other aspects of a broader conscious capitalism. So it's an important step.
Well, what I was going to say is I think there was a notion that conscious capitalism meant necessarily that you would have to sacrifice profit in some capacity as a business in order to meet these greater needs.
Right.
Whereas the conversation around purpose is far more focused on doing what you do best, but in the best possible way. And so not sacrificing profit, but rather, I know that these are very general ways of explaining it, but rather thinking about what you do best and the human needs and the market changes and bringing all these elements together. So I think there's leadership that's more conscious of this now. So there's less resistance to talking about it, where they're like, I can't sacrifice profit because my shareholders and my board will say, et cetera. So.
Yes, the idea of doing something that's kind of bigger than yourself, bigger than what you do as an organization, isn't it?
So. Exactly.
Nice. Well, those were the six. I think we did pretty good in terms of our predictions. It's interesting as we think back, but it's an interesting process, an interesting review, and something we should do again, Corinne. We should do this again.
I agree.
We should partner. Last couple of questions, Corinne, if we may. So just thinking about our HR audience, what advice would you have for them when it comes to preparing for the future?
I think it's as simple and as complicated as a word you mentioned earlier in this reporting, which was curiosity. I think as HR leaders, I know a little about the world of HR leadership, but certainly not as much as people who are listening and certainly not as much as you. But I do get the sense that there is a lot of constant change, and responding to those changes is a significant lift in policies and procedures and execution and in rallying large groups of employees, different types of employees around these changes. And that's a lot of work. And I would say, it is in those instances, much like any other leader would, can get caught up in the execution of and response to a change. And my thoughts to HR leaders would be to say, get curious before reacting, before putting practices and policies in place. There's a little bit of room to be curious, to better understand the context, people, and the situations a little more deeply. And also even get curious about, your leadership team and your board and the broader audience of stakeholders you have to respond to, and how their needs and their purview has changed. It goes a long way in that responsiveness and preparedness for the future. Mm-hmm. So it really does come down to curiosity. And again, like, I think as leaders, we're meant to have answers, but in these instances and in facing change all the time, I think it's important to pause and ask good questions as well. And maybe that's not specific enough, but that's my two cents.
No, that's great. That's great advice. Great advice. I like that. So maybe it leads to the final question. What would leaders need to do, or our listeners need to do, if they're curious about a faculty of change? Such a great question.
Well, please visit our website, facultyofchange.com. A lot of our thinking and a lot of our research is there. So if there are questions we're pondering that you have also been pondering, please contact us, let us know. I think for myself, I'm very happy to have conversations. There doesn't need to be an ask. There doesn't need to be a project associated with it. I'm just always keen to chat with people who are grappling with interesting questions and in different contexts. And so always happy to have a conversation to learn a little bit more. And so I would say, yes, please visit our website. Please read the material. If there's something interesting or if there's something you're thinking about or noodling on, don't hesitate to reach out.
Brilliant. We end with a feel good, which is just our theme on our newsletter. So what are you feeling good about right now? And you don't have to say this conversation. You can be much broader.
I'm feeling really good about the start of spring. Mm. I always feel a little bit of levity, even if it's interspersed with weird weather and gray days. I think I'm really looking forward to more sunshine. And so, yeah, that being outside more in the sun.
Brilliant. Well, thank you. I love this conversation. It's so good to connect with you and to explore these different topics, and appreciate you taking the time. I would encourage anybody to reach out to look up some of the work that Faculty of Change do on their website. I think it is really unique, and good on you for the work that you do.
Thank you.
To be partnering with you on different things. Thank you again to our listeners. Thank you for listening to the session today. If you think a friend or colleague would be interested, please do feel free to forward the episode on. Also, we always love a rating, as you know, but thanks again, Karee. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks for the opportunity to chat.
It's been great. Appreciate it. And we'll see you really soon. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Foresight. If you enjoyed the episode, we would love to hear from you. Leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Your ratings and reviews also help more people like you find our show so that we can reach more Future Forward leaders and achieve our mission of making work better.
Follow us on Instagram and LinkedIn at Future Forward, and sign up for our weekly newsletter, Foresight, on our website, futureforward.com.
That's FutureForward.com, where we share even more about the new world of work.
Talk to you next week.